Galaxy 13, Channel 16, Audio 7.70.
And welcome once again to the broadcast. A little technical difficulty here. I should be having a guest calling in as we disconnected with the phone system here. So, as I started out the broadcast talking through thin air, Anthony Hargis has gone through some turmoil by going against the grain, as I said before, to the airwaves with nobody listening. We have a situation in our country today where if you don't pay your fair share, supposedly, if you don't pay your fair share, you get slapped, sometimes very hard. And so at this point in time, Anthony is a perfect example of that, and I want you to hear his statement tonight and see where it goes. Here is a ad in the paper. A musical tribute during the National Week of Hope. It's the Decade of Hope, the Oklahoma City National Memorial. The Memorial Thank You Concert, recognizing the men and women who supported the OKC National Memorial with their generosity and giving spirit. The Oklahoma National Memorial, people, as a result of what happened on April 19, 1995. And this gets much publicity, this Friday, April 22nd date. Tickets for the concert are $10. Pre-show begins at 6:30 p.m. Special concert at 7 p.m. And you're encouraged to get them before they're gone. Tickets went on sale Monday, April 4th at the Ford Center office. And certainly this is regarding the website, the OklahomaCityNationalMemorial.org. You can look there yourself, the OklahomaCityNationalMemorial.org, presented by the Oklahoma City National Memorial and the Oklahoma City Centennial Commission. Once again, the setup of that situation is very relevant to those that have done the research. The more explosives in the building that were dismantled immediately, that the press covered, and then covered it up soon after. So, very, very sad situation here today, as more deceptions are being presented on us. And the people that are going to be here at this, Vince Gill, Jimmy Webb, Ty England, Katrina Alam, Toby Keith, Rodeo Opry, Byron Berline Band, and Joe Diffie. They're all going to be at this concert dedicated to those that fell on April 19th, 1995. I'm still anticipating that call from Anthony Hargis. I figured he'd call in by now because we did get disconnected. We see here Chief Executive's Board of the United Nations System for coordination, listeners. Dennis has done some tremendous research and put it on the website AmericanExpose.com, American spelled with a K. And they talk about the United Nations System Chief Executive's Board, the CEB, for coordination. Formerly the Administrative Committee on Coordination, the ACC, is the forum which brings the executive heads of all organizations to further coordination and cooperation on the whole range of substantive and management issues facing, what they say, not me, the United Nations system. Chaired by the Secretary General of the United Nations, the board meets twice annually. It is composed of the executive heads of the member organizations, as assisted by two high-level committees, the High-Level Committee on Programs, the HLCP, and the High-Level Committee on Management, the HLCM. Tremendous research by Dennis connecting to the UN system. The ACC, which is formerly the Committee on Coordination, was established by the Secretary General in 1946 at the request of the Economic and Social Council, ECOSOC, in Resolution 13, parentheses, Roman numeral 3. The main purpose of the committee was to supervise the implementation of the agreements between the United Nations and the specialized agencies. Since then, its mandate has grown to encompass the promotion of cooperation with the UN family in the pursuit of the common goals of member states across a wide range of substantive and management issues. From its original four members, the UN, ILO, FAO, and UNESCO, CEB today comprises 28 member organizations, including UN funds and programs, as well as specialized agencies, WTO, and the Bretton Woods institutions. How amazing. Quite a website. Absolutely incredible research available now. There is nothing to be hidden at this point in time. So what is their main focus? Apparently it's the follow-up on the Millennium Summit. And once again, if Anthony calls in, we'll just continue with this tomorrow night. I'm surprised he hasn't called in yet. So the follow-up of the Millennium Summit, themes for 2003 report of the Secretary General to the General Assembly include strategies for sustainable development and financing for development. So I see that this website has not been upgraded since 2003, although we continue to read. The first theme includes integrated and coordinated follow-up to the World Summit on Sustainable Development, as well as system-wide collaboration in the field of energy and water. Certainly water is the precious commodity of the 21st century, according to them, the UN system. Although water desalinization plants are very, 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 very easy to do, they say they cost too much. Well, how much does an M1 tank cost? How much does an attack helicopter cost? How much does depleted uranium ammunition cost? This is the whole point. Iraq is under UN control, totally now. That is the way it is. The second theme includes system-wide follow-up to the International Conference on Financing for Development, including international trade, the Doha Development Agenda, system-wide preparations for the 2005 Comprehensive Review of the Implementation of the Millennium Declaration, strengthening system-wide support for the sustainable development of Africa, focus on the new partnership for Africa's development, NEPAD, N-E-P-A-D. So the whole goal was the Millennium Summit from 2000 to bring about the continuing implementation of Agenda 21. And so this is what it's all about, the United Nations System Chief Executives Board and the High-Level Committee on Programs, which is the HLCP, is the principal mechanism for the system-wide coordination in the program area established by the United Nations System Chief Executives Board for Coordination, the CEB, in October 2000. Its main function is to advise CEB on policy, program, and operational matters of system-wide importance and to foster interagency cooperation and coordination on these matters on behalf of CEB. It is composed of senior representatives of member organizations who are responsible for program matters that are authorized to take decisions on behalf of their executive heads. So, what is my point here? It's big. It's a monster. And when you go through this official website locator for the United Nations System of Organizations, this has to have major prominence on the website so everyone can go to this anytime they want. This is going to help to increase everyone's knowledge about the vast expanse that the UN system has on us and the world. And once again, I just can't, when I look at this, I see insurmountable directions, listeners, why this is because we've spent so much time not knowing about it, because it's never been publicized to us. And this is why a lot of people, when you mention the United Nations, turn their heads or turn it off. Or eliminate their thought patterns from it. And here we see, in UNICEF, parliamentarians meeting, child protection a major issue. Always this situation of the women and the children being given major prominence in the UN system. And we see UNICEF Executive Director Carol Bellamy has told the world's lawmakers that new technology is making children more vulnerable to exploitation and abuse. And you can see this video at any time when you connect to UNESCO or UNICEF. Excuse me, this is UNICEF. And certainly this is the plan in place to impoverish the world, to destroy the middle class, which is what made this country strong and prominent over the years, is a strong middle class. The situation starts with the Federal Reserve, the way I see it today. I don't take it any farther back than that, hardly at all, because at this juncture, how are you going to wake people up? The first thing is the documentation. you have the documentation in your wallet you've been carrying with you all your life. The paper money says on the front, legal tender for all debts, public and private. That is the starting point for educating people. We see here UNICEF, government, and NGOs unite for children of Brazil. What just happened in Brazil? A major shooting. Here it is. Brazilian massacre, dated Saturday, April 2nd. Police licensed by investigations. I'm sorry. Police incensed by investigations of brutality and corruption by bad cops may have carried out a massacre in two impoverished suburbs of Rio de Janeiro, killing 27 people, state officials said Friday. Another victim was left brain dead in Thursday's onslaught in Nova Ignacio and Cumendo's crime-affected suburbs about 20 miles northwest of Rio, and Claudia Guerrero, a spokesperson. And this is according to Claudia Guerrero, a spokeswoman for the Rio Public Safety Department. Rio de Janeiro has full United Nations implementation in that country. In Quimaros, gunmen mowed down 12 people, some in Bible Square and others in front of a car wash, she said. In nearby Nova Ignacio, they killed 15 people. At a bar, she said. Quote, there are strong implications that the massacres could have been a reprisal for the arrest of 8 police officers suspected of killing 2 men in police station earlier this week, Guerrero said. The 8 were caught on camera dumping the bodies of the 2 men outside the station. Well, as I go here, dated April 6th, UNICEF, government, and NGOs unite for the children of Brazil, most impoverished region. Cabinet ministers, state governors, mayors, NGO, and business leaders, today, April 6th, launched an unprecedented national accord to improve the lives of some of the country's most impoverished and excluded children. Entitled A World for Children and Adolescents, listeners, the initiative will focus on providing support to poor children and families in Brazil's northeast or semi-arid region, launching a seal of approval that will be awarded to municipalities meeting a series of child-friendly criteria. At the launch in Petrolina and Juazeiro, participants reviewed the dramatic situation prevailing in the vast northeast of Brazil, an area the size of Colombia, as well as concrete measures needed to improve the lives of some 11 million children and enable them to enjoy their rights. Oh, yes. Education, nutrition, culture, social and political participation, diversity, and human rights are the major topics of the panels and debates. Tomorrow, April 7th, in concert, will be held to celebrate the National Accord. That's right, a concert will be held to celebrate the National Accord with UNICEF Goodwill Ambassadors Renato Arago and Daniela Mercury. Daniela will perform a special song selection with tunes related to the semi-arid. The concert will highlight the cultural heritage of the region and will accomplish and be accompanied by popular and local artists, and will talk about the responsibility of the rest of Brazil to help the region develop. So we have a Brazilian massacre on April 2nd. We have this meeting addressing the children in Brazil, not related. But we have a concert on April 19th. Dedicated to the Oklahoma City Memorial, and they have a concert in Brazil for the children. Very interesting. The UNICEF Municipal Seal of Approval will encourage mayors to give top priority to children and youth and to adopt policies to reduce child mortality, child labor, and illiteracy among adolescents. Local authorities will also be recognized for promoting vaccination campaigns. Oh, yes, vaccination campaigns, prenatal care, increased school attendance, among other measures. The municipalities achieving the greatest improvements for children will be recognized by UNICEF at the end of 2006. Around 26 million people, 11 million of them children, live in the Brazilian semi-arid region, distributed in 1,500 municipalities in the departments of Alagoas. Oh, there's no point in rambling off these names. I'll butcher most of them. 75% of the children, more than 8 million, are living in poverty. And the mortality rate in 95% of the municipalities is higher than the national average. According to this information, UNICEF, government, and NGOs unite for the children of Brazil's most impoverished region. The UN system is very, very involved in world government control, utilizing the children. Economies of countries collapse by design. Also, UNICEF calls for enhanced global commitment to support countries in crisis. From Dubai, dated April 5, 2005, speaking from the Dubai International Convention Center, UNICEF Deputy Executive Director Rima Salah today launched the Humanitarian Action Report 2005 and called on the donor community, Arab funds, and humanitarian agencies to exhort improved effort in leveraging the region's capacity to respond to persisting emergencies around the globe. The persisting emergencies around the globe, what kind of created crisis brought them about? Or were they done naturally? That's where we have a problem. In the framework of the Dubai International Humanitarian Aid and Redevelopment Conference and Exhibition, UNICEF stressed the need to revitalize the focus on technical assistance and prioritization of humanitarian aid to countries still ravaged by armed confrontation, political and social economic instability, natural disasters, and HIV/AIDS. Once again, HIV/AIDS, according to certain sources, was a designer disease developed in the 1970s. Natural disasters could be created. Absolutely. There's too much documentation about this to create earthquakes, to create weather anomalies. HARP, we don't know what the bottom line of HARP is. Social economic instability, certainly. That is created by the destruction of the family by various different avenues. The Tavistock Institute comes to mind when they talk, when we talk about, or I talk about, the destruction of the family unit. The Tavistock Institute immediately comes to my mind out of England. Armed confrontation. What brings about an armed confrontation, listeners? What is the reasoning behind armed confrontations? Remember, wars for national liberation, communist-inspired, starting way back at the beginning of this century, the beginning of the last century. So once again, I'm going to repeat that paragraph. In the framework of the Dubai, or the Dubai International Humanitarian Aid and Redevelopment Conference and Exhibition, UNICEF stressed the need to revitalize the focus on technical assistance and the prioritization of humanitarian aid to countries still ravaged by armed conflict, political and social economic instability, natural disasters, and HIV/AIDS. Are they all Hegelian dialectic directions, listeners? That's my point. The UNICEF Humanitarian Action Report 2005 represents an overview of crisis countries where children continue to face severe deprivations of their rights to survival, health and nutrition, education and protection from harm, exploitation and discrimination. Once again, is the Hegelian dialectic involved in any and all of these? It also lays emphasis on funding appeals and plans of action in the area of humanitarian response in the year ahead. Quote, hundreds of millions of children worldwide are born with the basic rights already denied as the threats of poverty, armed conflict, and HIV/AIDS replicate from one generation to the next, end quote, UNICEF Deputy Executive Director said. Quote, moreover, we are at risk of seeing last decade's achievements in the child development area decline as we have failed to recommit to our moral and legal responsibility to safeguard future generations from harm and abuse, end quote, she said. With an eye on enduring conflict and emergency situations in the Arab world, the UNICEF report reviews the effects of humanitarian action taken in post-war Iraq, Darfur, Sudan, and the occupied Palestinian territory. Additional reference is given to countries vulnerable to natural disasters, such as Iran, Algeria, Sudan, and Djibouti, where recent floods and earthquakes have left thousands of people displaced and homeless. And once again, does environmental modification have anything to do with that? UNICEF called for reinvigorated contributions to conflict-ridden Darfur, where an estimated 1.3 million are children and around 550,000 children under five are particularly vulnerable to the effects of violence, abuse, hunger, disease, and exploitation. Today, more than 1 million people in the Darfur area continue to lack safe water. 70% of children are out of school, and women and children are exposed to ongoing violence. Where does that violence come from? Who is behind it? Where is the funding coming from for the violence? I saw a little portion of a program on the Learning Channel tonight. Just a portion of it. And it was one of these programs where your house is a mess and a crew comes in and cleans it up and fixes it up for you. The particular guest or house that was being utilized, the owner of the house, the man of the house, was wearing a gray T-shirt with a red hammer and sickle on the T-shirt. Hammer and sickle from the Soviet era. Do I have my guest? Okay, I don't have... Good. Anthony, I'm sorry we misconnected again.
Yes.
Can you speak up as loud as you can?
Okay. Does this work?
I'm sure this will work fine.
Okay.
Yeah. And once again, listeners, where we were was in UNICEF, and we're connecting to the, once again, the new edition of the website, which is going to have major prominence, the official website locator for the United Nations System of Organizations, and that is where we leave it now. As Anthony Hargis is with us, and my point is, with what we're doing tonight, we're going to commercial pause, but the government claimed that Anthony helped organize illegal tax schemes, but could find no evidence of it. And so we frequently hear people punished for a crime they didn't commit. Anthony Hargis was punished for a crime that never happened. So we're going to go to pause right now, and when we come back, we're going to hear from Anthony and his dilemma. And if we have to, we'll continue tomorrow night. We'll be right back.
Chris?
Hang on, Anthony.
You're listening to FirstAmendmentRadio.com, Galaxy 13, Channel 16, Audio 7.70, and worldwide on the Internet at FirstAmendmentRadio.com.
Who performed the first organ transplant? Find out on today's Creation Moment. And now, here's our Creation Moments host, Ian Taylor.
Of all the creatures that walk, crawl, creep, or grow on Earth, which one invented the organ transplant? I'll give you one hint. It wasn't a human being. Actually, several creatures perform organ transplants, and the inventor must be God, because mindless natural forces could never have worked out the amazing transplants we see in our world. Sea slugs feed mainly on sea anemones. Sea anemones have stinging cells, which, upon the slightest touch, explode, sending a poisonous dart into the intruder. None of this seems to faze the sea slug, who will tear up the anemone and eat it without exploding even one of the stinging cells. The stinging cells do not even explode in the slug's stomach, nor, amazingly, are they digested. The sea slug's stomach has narrowed channels. These channels have moving hairs, which sweep the stinging cells out of the stomach, up the channels, and to the pouches, where they are arranged and stored so that the sea slug can use them for his own defense. Should a fish try to nip the sea slug, he would be stung by the very stinging cells which had once protected the anemone. Science tells us that things must have causes. It is hardly scientific to credit an organ transplant, which is more complex and elegant than anything we could devise, to blind natural principles. The Bible has a better and more logical answer.
To get a complete set of transcripts from Creation Moments programs, ask about the book Letting God Create Your Day when you visit us online at creationmoments.com. Join us again for another Creation Moment, proclaiming evidence of God's truth.
Broadcast. We are with Anthony Hargis now. Anthony, can you hear me all right?
Yes.
Okay, very good. So the government jailed you for five and a half months for refusing to disclose records. They confiscated your company, its property belonging entirely to its customers, which was repeatedly asserted by the government. That's quite a traumatic situation that happened to you. And what is the circumstance behind all this, Anthony?
Well, it all started when they sent a letter to me telling me that they wanted to investigate me to determine whether or not I was subject to penalties under Section 6700 and 6701 of the Internal Revenue Code. Now, the first section says it's illegal to organize tax shelters and represent that the expenses thereof are tax deductible and that you know that they are not legally deductible. And that the second section says it is illegal for income tax return preparers to prepare a tax return and enter unlawful deductions. Now, I do none of this. I never have, and I think, and most people who look at my case think that the real reason for the prosecution was to silence me for some of the opinions I've put in my books. One thing that supports this conclusion is that I like to tell people that if I or my customers had violated any law, or if our legal arguments were groundless, the government would have been delighted to take this case to trial and make a three-ring circus out of it and to make a damn fool of me. I mean, this is what they like to do to people who criticize the tax system. But, of course, it didn't happen.
What was the company once again? What type of company was it?
Okay. I organized this company about 28 years ago, as an alternative to the Federal Reserve System. I had come to the conclusion that this country was occupied by thieves, and their main weapon of plunder or occupation was the Federal Reserve. And I figured that as long as we're using Federal Reserve notes and Federal Reserve bank accounts, we cannot win. Somebody had to create an alternative. And I didn't have the patience to wait for someone else to do it, so I did it myself. So I started to offer a gold-backed banking service. This allowed my customers to never set foot again in an ordinary bank, and operated this for something like 28 years until it was destroyed by the government last year. So that's the nature of the company that I was operating. And in the meantime, I did a fair amount of research on taxes, the Federal Reserve, and various constitutional rights, and I put my findings in little booklets, or what I call writings. And I think some of my customers and readers say that I was coming too close to the truth, and the government had to shut me down, or they had to silence me. And that's what we think the lawsuit was about.
Interesting. And so the direction to incarcerate you came from this organization you formed.
Now say it again.
This situation where you were incarcerated is a result of you avoiding certain tax mandates on you?
Well, particularly, see, the IRS wanted me to surrender records pertaining to my activity under 6700 and 6701. And for one thing, I had never done anything of that nature, so I had no applicable records. Another objection that we had was that the summons that they gave to me, we described it as a third-party summons disguised as a first-party summons, and everything about it was illegal. See, they asked for all records of my customers. Now, by law, when you want someone to surrender records pertaining to someone else, that's a third-party summons. And in this case, in this situation, each third party has to be particularly described. He must be given a notice of this summons, and he must be given an opportunity to challenge it. None of these three elements was present, which made the summons illegal. For example, I think I've already said it. They wanted records of all customers, and they didn't name them. Now, this is what the Supreme Court calls this a fishing expedition, and they say it's not legal. So, although this was not really an issue, the first issue was that we had no applicable records. The second issue is that it was this illegal nature of the summons. Now, we refused to produce records, and the government, they filed a lawsuit to compel me to produce the records. Now, in these kinds of hearings, the practice is that the victim is required to disprove the allegation of the government. Now, this requires the courts to give such a victim an opportunity to carry this burden. But in our case, we never had that opportunity. We never had the chance to examine our accuser or witness, whatever you want to call them. And that the court ordered me to another meeting and to produce the records. Well, I went to the meeting, didn't produce the records, and then one thing led to another. I was taken off to jail because of that.
So you were presumed guilty?
To put it modestly, yes. I was also presumed that it was impossible. one way my paralegal likes to phrase it is that the way it's, the courts operate today, it's impossible for the government to lie. It's impossible for the taxpayer to tell the truth. So based on that, there's just no need to let the taxpayer speak.
I'll be darned. And what kind of laws and dictates are there that mandates that you comply with what they want you to comply with?
Well, like I say, it was, I would call them, what we were dealing with was a star chamber. This is taken directly out of the Catholic Inquisition. Okay, I'm not quite clear on your question there.
Well, you're on the right direction. Go ahead.
Let me think.
A star chamber, meaning you were set up, like most people are set up, like Joe Bannister quit his job. I'm sure you know who he is.
Right.
And he quit because he has a conscience, evidently.
Right.
And so there's no real law that says you have to pay income tax.
Right.
But this is just the tip of the iceberg for you in your direction, isn't it?
Right. Yeah.
Well, evidently the real purpose was to retaliate against you for the treasons and information explained in your writings, like you said before.
Right.
Now, your writings are needed to be expressed by you right now, and then we're going to give out the address where people can contact you and get your writings.
Okay. One that's real, I think, relatively easy and quick to explain is a book that I put together by the title of the title is Plantation America, and this focuses on the meaning of the word individual. Now, this is important because the income tax is imposed on the income of every individual. Now, this is Section 1 of the tax code. Most people focus on the word income, and they spend years researching that word to try to get out from under that word. Now, I decided to research the word individual. The first tax act after the so-called ratification of the 16th Amendment had the definition for individual, but since then it has been moved out of the tax code and put into the Privacy Act. The definition there for individual is a citizen of the United States or a resident alien. Now, most people would think, well, maybe I'm a citizen of the U.S. Now, let's look at this. Title 42, Section 1982, you'll find this language. Quote, all citizens of the United States shall have the same right as is enjoyed by white citizens. Close quote. Now, that's not the complete section, but you'll find that language. Now, this language comes directly from the Civil Rights Act of 1866. The purpose of this act was to give a certain kind of status to the recently freed black slaves and to give them property rights relative to state governments. And it said that the black citizens or the U.S. citizens shall have the same right as is enjoyed by white citizens. See, the white citizens already had these rights and this standing.
Mm-hmm.
So, by this language, Congress created a distinction between black citizen and white citizen, which is also known as a state citizen. Keep in mind that this term white citizen is a language of Congress. I didn't invent this. Now, what's so important about this is that it's more than just a difference in label. The U.S. citizen has no standing under the federal constitution or the Bill of Rights. The white citizen or the state citizen does have full standing and all protections and all rights under the Bill of Rights. language from the Civil Rights Act was later raised to constitutional status by the 14th Amendment. So we're talking about constitutional language here. Now, most people born in this country are born as state citizens or white citizens. In other words, they're born with full rights under the Bill of Rights. When they apply for a Social Security card, they volunteer into the status of U.S. citizen because a Social Security card is available only to individuals as defined according to the definition that I gave earlier. Now, in other words, when you volunteer into this status, you volunteer to surrender all of your rights under the Bill of Rights, and in exchange for this, you get to pay taxes for the rest of your life. Now, as far as I'm concerned, the real issue here is not taxes, it is your rights. Do you have rights after you apply for the Social Security card? Now, I gave my information to a mainstream lawyer who researched this for more than 2 years, and then we decided to file a lawsuit against the Social Security Administration to settle a question of law. Do we surrender any rights when we apply for the SS card? Now, the government or the courts almost rapidly dismissed this case, and before we could carry this on appeal, I was taken down by the IRS in the case where I was arrested and the company seized. When the government seized that company, they deprived me of all means to defend the case against it. I mean, the case they filed against me, not to mention the ability to pursue this lawsuit against the Social Security Administration. What I had done with that latter lawsuit, I put the court in a position where it had to commit a gigantic fraud by protecting the Social Security Administration, or it had to expose a gigantic treason. Because you see, supposedly the purpose of the U.S. government is to protect our rights, but by compelling us or manipulating us into volunteering to apply for the Social Security card, they have essentially deprived an entire nation of its birthright. It has effectively destroyed the Constitution, because by us volunteering into this U.S. citizenship status, the status of we the people has become empty. There's no one in it, or practically no one in it. And these are the parties to the Constitution. If you got no parties to a contract, there's no contract. So it's by this means that they have destroyed the Constitution, as well as deprived us of all of our rights. So that's my 10-minute presentation on that book.
Plantation America.
Yes.
Which is $24.
Yes, and that includes shipping.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and do we have time to talk about the lost rights?
Yeah, I think we have a good 10 minutes, I think.
Okay. Now, I think that book is even more important because this explores the right of petition. And I claim that there's millions of people out there using the right of petition, but they're only using maybe 5% of its power. The reason for this is that the knowledge of the remaining 95% has been lost. Here's what I mean by that. When I was doing research on the official enactments by the Continental Congress, I ran across this passage. When governments become oppressive, we Americans have the right to withhold our taxes until the government redresses our grievances. Now, this is a very significant principle of law. This was one of the major rights that the founders intended to secure by the Revolution. Now, when I saw that, you see, the current practice is that if you have a grievance, you've got to pay your taxes, and if you have anything left over, then you'll be able to sue to recover your taxes or to redress the grievance. Well, you can never do that because the government will make sure that the taxes will, if you pay your taxes, you'll be financially ruined. Now, when I saw this passage enacted by the Continental Congress, I decided to go back into English history and find examples of where Parliament had imposed this principle of redress before taxes. And I examined the history between 1604 and 1688. This was a time when Englishmen were crossing the Atlantic to settle in America. And I found scores of examples where Parliament required redress before taxes. I found, see, now Parliament in constitutional language is a constitutional assembly. It's the same kind of assembly that is guaranteed to us by the First Amendment. Now, the assembly is a body of private men. And the English Parliament during this time period did some really remarkable things that we need to learn about. For example, when Parliament met, the entire nation understood that they were to take their grievances to Parliament, and Parliament would examine them and then turn them over to the king for redress. And if the king was required to give redress before he could receive taxes from Parliament. Now, when the king did not provide redress, Parliament took matters into its own hands, and it exercised the power of judgment, of prosecution, of investigation, and finally of executing its judgments. It prosecuted judges for rendering unlawful judgments, for intimidating juries, for handing down cruel and unusual punishments, for imposing excessive fines and bails. It prosecuted tax collectors for imposing and collecting taxes that had not received the assent of Parliament. It prosecuted all sorts of men for promoting the doctrine of divine right of kings. In other words, that the king could not be sued except by his own consent. Now, the punishments for these crimes range from fines, loss of office, banishment, and even loss of head. Now, what makes this so remarkable is that these prosecutions were done by private men. Now, we have the same rights. It's reserved to us by the First Amendment. And what I'm trying to do with I've put all this information in my book, Lost Rights, and that also goes for $24. And eventually, you'll have a link where people can read a brief review of this this book. Let's see. The parliaments during this time period, they had to deal with the same grievances that we have to deal with today. What I'd like to say is that our story was written 400 years ago by these English parliaments. The events that they had to live through are the events that we'll have to live through. We'll have to reestablish the principles and the rights and the procedures that they used at that time period. And I like to say that we can spend the next 400 years reinventing these procedures, or we can spend 2 weeks examining the history that I put in my book and verifying it. It seems to me that it's a lot easier to take the second option there.
A lot of research has gone into your writings. That's very obvious to me.
Yeah, and I encourage people. See, I've had both these books, Plantation America and Lost Right, examined by lawyers, and they've passed the test. I would estimate that there may be half a dozen lawyers in this country who begin to understand the power of petition. And I think I can safely say that all six of these lawyers learned part or most of what they know about the right of petition from my book.
And that's because the truth is a secret.
Right. This information has been suppressed. It has been lost. You can go in and read your law reviews, your court cases. There's absolutely nothing in the law books or the history books remotely similar to what I've put in mine.
Well, let me make sure the listeners have your address and certainly get your writing material ready for that, listeners. And the address is 2427, that's 2427 North Tustin Avenue, T-U-S-T-I-N Avenue, Suite B9, and that's in Santa Ana, California, S-A-N-T-A, next word, A-N-A, S-A-N-T-A, A-N-A, California, 92705.
Right.
That's Anthony Hargis, H-A-R-G-I-S, 2427 North Tustin Avenue, Suite B9, Santa Ana, California, 92705. I'll give that out one more time before we close off. The third publication, Anthony, is The American Inquisition.
Right. Yeah, this this could have been the star witness at our trial, but we were cut off at the pass. If our case could have gone to trial, we could have spent 2 days examining this book and disinfected the minds of the jurors and probably everyone in the audience, but the government couldn't allow that.
Now, keep in mind, we're just about out of time. Will you be able to call the number and come in tomorrow night again?
You know, I think I need more time. I mean, we had some difficulty tonight. I think we should avoid that by taking more time. I've got difficulty securing a phone.
Would a night next week, Tuesday, Wednesday, or Thursday, one of those nights work better for you?
I think so, because the more time I've got, the better we can secure our schedule here.
Okay, because we're just about out of time, and I'm sorry for our complication.
Yeah. I try to do too much too fast.
Well, we'll work it out this next time as you get a hold of me for when you can come back next week.
Okay.
And once again, your phone number or your address, the address for Anthony Hargis, listeners, all three of these publications are $24 apiece.
Right.
And the title of the first one is Plantation America. The second one is Lost Right. And the third one is American Inquisition. And it all deals with the propaganda in place to mandate that we have to pay our taxes in certain directions, and he covers it very well. The address one more time, and we're just about out of time. 2427 North Tustin Avenue. That's 2427 North Tustin Avenue. And that's Suite B9, Santa Ana, California, 92705. 2427 North Tustin Avenue, Suite B9, Santa Ana, California, 92705. And Anthony, thank you for joining us tonight.
And I apologize for the difficulties.
Well, we'll work it out next week, and I'm sorry myself.
Yeah.
I'll call you after the show here.
Okay.
Okay, listeners, that's it for tonight, and God bless you all.
Who are you? That is the question, and